Okay. Welcome to my call with Tom Hubiar. This is Perry Marshall. Tom, are you, can you hear me okay?
Oh, I can hear you clearly, Perry.
Okay, perfect. Well, this is going to be a little bit of a different kind of teleseminar. And I why would we do a crazy teleseminar like this? I guess it's to humanize what goes on, just to let you know that no one's immune to the crazy stuff that goes on in the world, and I think the appropriate place to begin this conversation is to explain. Tom and I really became friends. We met at a Gary Halbert seminar, which I want to say was about 7 years ago, and we hit it off because I had just successfully bailed out of a high-tech company with check in hand, and he was the CEO of a high-tech company hoping that he someday would bail with check in hand. And we just, had a lot in common. And so we had, late-night conversations and talked for days, and a Halbert seminar was a pretty trippy place to be hanging out anyway, and so that was great. Well, then we were in a coaching group together, and we were, knocking swords in a small group mastermind together, and so we're getting to know each other there. And then something interesting happened. I think, Tom, was it 3 years ago?
When? You talking about when I left the company?
Yeah, that was...
Yeah, 4 years ago, actually. Just 4 years ago last week.
Okay, so yeah, 4 years ago, it's like on a Saturday or something,
yeah.
I get this call from Tom. And Tom goes, "Well, Perry, I just got fired as CEO of my company. Like, they just threw me out." Like, they what? Yeah, they threw me out. Now, he's going to tell you more of that story later, okay? But Tom says to me, he goes, you're a little ahead of me in this whole mastering marketing game. Would it be okay if we talked every day, every Friday? Because he says, I think that would help me get this off the ground. And I think about it for a second, like, wow, like, talking once a week, that's a lot. And I was a little bit reluctant, but I said, okay, yeah, we could do that. And what I didn't know at the time was that this was going to be, I was probably going to get a whole lot more out of it than he was. Now, he might debate that,
yeah.
But this from my point of view, I didn't know how important those Friday conversations would eventually turn out to be, because I didn't know what was going to go on in my own life.
Yeah.
Okay? Because at the time it was like, well, okay, I'm ahead of Tom in as a marketer, but of course Tom's way ahead of me. Tom is 28 years older than me. Tom's old enough to be my father. Matter of fact, he's the same age my father would be if my father was still alive. And Tom's had 40 different careers, literally. Like from cowboy to private investigator to ad agency executive to CEO to like all kinds of bizarre things that Tom has done in his life.
There's a few I won't mention.
And he's on his third marriage, which is a good one this time.
Yeah.
He will talk about that. Like I didn't know how much I was going to need Tom's life experience, because really, what the trade ended up being was I had expertise, Tom had experience. A guy who's 30-something doesn't know how badly he might need a guy in his 60s who has experience. And just to kind of fill you in a little bit, about 2.5 years ago, my midlife stuff started happening. And if you go back 2 years from right now, which would be like the summer of 07, I was a complete mess. Like, I'm not exaggerating at all. I was barely functional. I had just, like, my emotional shit hit the fan, and I didn't really know what was all buried under there. So when we started, you know, sweeping out what was under the rug, it was pretty ugly. And Tom was a major, major help in helping me see what was going on and navigating through that, and it's really been priceless. And it's so kind of funny, like just a couple days ago, we were having one of these like really weird, trippy conversations, like, you know what? You know, this is too good not to talk about. And there are so many things here. And so, like, I think people, when you're in the trenches and you're fighting and struggling, you look at people that are where you want to be. Like, you go, oh, well, you know, I want to have a bigger, more successful business someday, or whatever it is that you're doing. And I don't know why, but somehow people tend to assume that the people that they see living the life they wish they could live don't have the same problems that they do, you know? Well, it's not really true. And so, like, I just decided, you know what? Let's have this phone call and let's talk about this stuff. And let's introduce people to the crazy world of Tom and some of these conversations. Let's let you eavesdrop on some of these conversations. So Tom, welcome.
Thanks a lot, Perry. That was quite an introduction.
It's really nice to have you here.
Yeah. Well, I would say, you know, part of this was built because you and I roomed together during those coaching things, and we keep each other up all night doing religion and politics and every other damn thing. So we had a real good bond of trust before we started our coaching relationship, and yeah, it's been fun to learn from you about the online internet stuff. At the same time, I'm able to share with you, I think I had the easy part of this, because all I had to do was to go back into memory and remember one of those times that truck came out of a side road and smashed me, to say to you, you know, check that side road on the right coming up ahead there. It's liable to be a problem for you.
Right.
And so I, you know, part of it for me is like a do-over. It's when I get to coach somebody younger than me, it's, you know, I get to help them get it right. I mean, you really, frankly, have lived so much more gracefully than I did through your 30s. And we'll talk about that, because my midlife was much more abrupt and traumatic than yours. It went faster, but it left a lot of wreckage behind.
Well, maybe we can help people minimize some wreckage.
Yeah, I would hope so.
Or even, you know, sometimes there's an element of forgiving yourself if you created some.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all got stuff that we regret.
Well, I think that's a big piece, and I think you're right. And certainly the first couple of times it hit me, it took years before I pieced it back together again.
So Tom, okay, you're 68 years old. You're married. You've got children. You've got grandchildren.
Yeah.
You've got colleagues. All, but like, go back to, take us back to high school, and you know what kind of rowdy character
was. I was very quiet, but okay. Let me set the stage. I'm a lot older than most of the folks on this call, and let me tell you how I grew up, because you guys grew up differently. You guys grew up in a country that had a president shot. I consider that a coup d'etat, but so your government was changed. You grew up after Korea and after Vietnam. I grew up right after World War II. Now, you grew up after Vietnam. 300 million people in this country. We had 57 guys killed in Nam. That was bad. But I grew up after World War II. There was only 130 million people in this country, and we lost almost 500,000 dead in World War II. And we won it. And our president was the guy that won that war. So when I was a teenager, Eisenhower was the president. The world was, you know, there was no civil rights. There was no equal rights for women. None of that was even on the horizon. We lived in a society that was like a straitjacket for a teenager. The only options the teenagers had were, besides being quiet, were to get through school and get into college, or get a job or go to jail. And I was this bright misfit that didn't fit in school at all. And so I had actually left a couple years earlier. I left school at 15 because I thought I wanted to try something different. So my dad set me up on a ranch with a friend of his, and I was a cowboy for the better part of 2 years. Very, very hard physical labor. And it was a fascinating experience for a kid who grew up in the suburbs to all of a sudden live this romantic life. And like most of my adventures, it's a lot easier to talk about than to live through. It was cold. It was bumpy. You get up at 4:30 in the morning. You go out and break your horse and saddle them because they don't want to work either. And so the first thing they try to do is to kill you. And this is before you even have coffee in the morning. So you start the day in a bad mood. And then you work for about an hour. Then you come in and eat a huge breakfast. Then you go out, climb on your horse. And I was doing roundup. So then you're out for 14 hours a day rounding up cattle. Anyway, it's a tough life. I gained a lot of weight. And then I came back and thought, you know, I got to go to school. My parents had told me I'd be a ditch digger. I have to say, Perry, with 40 jobs, 40-plus jobs, I've never dug ditches for a living. I think I've had worse jobs, but I don't know where they keep these ditch diggers. I expect to see a lot of guys from my generation out there digging ditches on the side of the road. You know, I don't see that. So, but I did have some shitty jobs.
Maybe they're talking about Cool Hand Luke. Maybe they're all digging ditches in a prison camp.
Yeah,
somewhere.
I think they're all. I think you're right. They're wearing orange. So anyway, I go back to school, and because my dad was a pretty big wheel in this town that we lived in, I got to. He made a deal with a high school, so I could do my junior year and senior year combined. So you know, it was hell for me because I had English and history and physics and chemistry and geometry and algebra all in one day. I didn't have any light loads at all. And so I needed help from the algebra teacher to do some of the geometry work, and I was, like, totally on triple probation. You know, if I even farted in class, I was going to be out. I was going to be digging ditches. So one day, and the algebra teacher didn't like me because he thought I was getting special privileges even though I was doing the work. Well, came to school one day, and the algebra teacher said, you weren't here yesterday, Hubiar, so you're out. You're a truant. Go see the vice principal. Well, that would have been death for me, and I'd been there. I said, no, I was here. I was sitting right there. Some of the other kids said, yeah, he was right over there. And the teacher said, look, you weren't where you belong in the seating chart. As far as I'm concerned, it's an absence. Go explain yourself to the vice principal. So as I started to get up, and I could feel my heart drop down through my stomach, I almost wet my pants because I realized that for me, life was over. And I'm frantically wondering, can I bring one of these kids in as a witness? Will the vice principal believe me that I was actually in class, that I didn't break my promise, I didn't let him down? How will I explain this to my folks? And I'm walking to the door thinking about that, and the teacher said, oh, Hubiar. And I turned around, and he said, you might as well turn in your algebra book. You won't be needing it anymore. And I saw the smirk on his face, and something snapped in me. And the algebra book is a very heavy, hardbound book, and I frisbeed it at him. I just sailed it at him. And wouldn't you know it, that's one of the times when the book didn't blow open. It stayed closed. It sailed perfectly, and I watched with horror as this thing spun around. The corner of it clipped him right over the ear, and he dropped like a shot. And the class goes, ooh. And I'm thinking, I'm so screwed. Now, I probably killed this man. So I left, and I'm thinking, if I go to the vice principal's office, the police will find me there, and they'll take me to jail, and I'll get gang raped, and that'll, you know, be the end of my life. So I didn't. I left, actually just left the school, and I went and sat in a coffee shop for a couple of hours. Then I decided the best thing to do would be to pretend that nothing had happened. You know, first step, denial, right? So I got home at the time I would normally come home from school and told everybody things were fine. My folks came home from their work, and we had dinner. Next morning, I get up, get ready for school, get my books together, get my lunch money, leave the house, and go to this coffee shop, which was a businessman's coffee shop. School kids didn't hang out here. And I'd sit around in there and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes and read. I didn't know what else to do. At the end of the day, I left and I went home. I checked the mailbox to make sure there wasn't anything from the school. I looked out down the street. There were no police cars around my house. So went in, and I did that same routine. I did that routine for 6 weeks. And when I did get letters from the school addressed to my parents, wondering where Tom was, I wrote them back using my mom's. My mom was a social worker for the state of California, and she traveled a good deal. And I wrote them back and just said, Tom's traveling with us. He'll be back in a month. And back then, parents had authority to do those sorts of things, and so we got away with it. And, of course, by the time that whole thing came to a close, I had enlisted in the military. And the way I got busted was the head of the recruiting office called my father and said, why are you letting this kid enlist? He's throwing away a great academic career. And, of course, then everything boiled over. And everybody, it was a big, ugly scene. But I was adamant, and so I was allowed to go into the military because it was clear I wasn't going to make it in high school. So there was a situation where my life ended. It ended in a moment. And it actually took, I think I was like 3 years later, I'm at sea in a destroyer in the North Atlantic. No, it was actually the year before that was the first time I realized what had happened. I was on guard duty attached to a Marine Guard Company in North Africa. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. My guard shift goes until 4. I'm walking by a fence, and I see a big hole in the cyclone fence in the middle of a eucalyptus grove. And I see footprints leading in and no prints leading out. And so I know that there's somebody, sappers or saboteurs or somebody inside in the base. And this is a small little outpost, maybe 250 people. So, and I'm the only one between the bad guys inside the base and them getting out. And we didn't have walkie-talkies back then. The technology wasn't there. So I'm thinking I'll back up against the fence so I can see him when he comes out. Trouble is, if I'm back up against the fence, somebody can stick a knife at me from behind. So it was a really creepy place to be. So I sort of stayed away from the fence and kept an eye on things and thinking to myself, son of a bitch, if I played my cards right, I'd be going to my high school prom right now. I still remember that thought, thinking, instead of that, I'm out here where somebody can take me out, and the only way they're going to find me is when I don't rendezvous. Every 15 minutes, we would meet guards at the end of our post. And then eventually, I heard a Jeep. I could hear it gearing down as it went over the roads and bumped along. I could see the headlights coming through the dust as they came out to get me. And then we could send a patrol out and find these guys. So it was an interesting realization. Then a year later, when we were at sea in a bad patch in the North Atlantic, and I'm in this, we used to call her a bucket of bolts, this beat-up old destroyer, and we're bouncing along, and we had 4 guys washed overboard. It was November. It was colder than hell. And again, I was thinking, son of a bitch. If I had played my cards right, I would have had a completely different life from this. So, you know, the problem with that kind of thinking is that it's a, what do we call it, woulda, shoulda, coulda?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I just hate that kind of thinking. I mean, I really hate that because it's regrets. And it wasn't the last time it happened, but I still remember how bitter those regrets were.
Mm.
Several experiences I had in the military. Overall, I think it was good. It taught me to be a man, taught me to grow up. And the plus side was I lived through it, and that helped. But the downside was I really knew so little that those little screw-ups would blossom. You know, those choices you make would blossom and turn to big things. And I just had no plan B. I didn't have a backup. So I guess the lesson we learned there was it'd be good if you took less than 5 years to rethink an event that defined your life.
Hmm.
You know, actually the same thing happened a few years later in my first marriage. I got married young because I thought, you know, what do you need on your list? Well, I'm trying to catch up since I missed high school. I finished high school, by the way, in the first couple of years of college in the military with tests and courses. And so when I came out, I was on fire to get through college and, you know, get good job, good wages, et cetera, maybe law school. So 23 years old, so I have this list, house in the suburbs, dog, cat, wife, college degree, right? So I just started going down the list. I acquired the dog, the cat, the house, and the wife. And but I was working full-time and going to school nights and giving her a list of books that she ought to read. you know, just trying to create this life. And so my best friend would be able to, he had evenings free, so I encouraged him to go out to dinner a lot, go to the concerts and stuff, because I didn't have time for that. I was busy. Well, so I guess this wouldn't come as a shock to you when it turned out that they developed a closer relationship than I did. So they took me out to dinner, and at dinner I knew that I was having trouble with her. And then it comes out that they're basically had fallen in love. So that was a shock to me to have over dinner. And we got back to the house.
Well, how did they tell you this?
What
did he say?
It kind of came out, you know, and this is, I don't know if I've suppressed the memory. We're sitting at dinner, and I'm telling him about my plans. I think I was telling him how I was going to change things. I was going to take a semester off school. I'd spend time with the wife. So I'd like it if he made other plans. And didn't hang around so much. And I saw the look between the two of them, and I thought, that's an odd look. And then she started to say something, and he signaled her, and then he spoke for both of them. And so that told me a lot.
Mm.
Remember, we'd been like the Three Musketeers. You know, we'd been to the beach together, we'd been to movies together, we'd been on his honeymoon with him, so marriage it didn't last. So I just said, when it got to a point where I knew it was going to get difficult, and I said, we better continue this conversation back at the house. Because I wasn't sure what was going to come up. I didn't know if it was going to get, I didn't know if I could contain myself, frankly. But I knew that there was cutlery on the table. You know, I was ex-military, as was he. And I didn't want anything to happen in a restaurant, so I figured it'd be better if we were back to the house. So we got back to the house, and she went back to our bedroom and went to bed. He and I sat up and drank a bottle of brandy while he tried to explain to me how innocently they had fallen in love. And yeah, right.
Yeah.
I was innocent enough to buy it. It was really weird. And so I had to get around the idea that, well, I guess there won't be any law school or house in the suburbs. I don't know what I'm going to do with the dog and the cat. So I had to think things through that night. I still remember that. It was a very long night. And in the morning, I decided that what I wanted to do was to try to leave no wreckage behind. I remembered that high school thing, and I thought, it'd be better if I didn't leave a body on the floor this time. I remember having that thought. Because I had actually, as I said, this guy was ex-military. We'd known each other before, and I knew I could take him. I had done it once before when we were younger. So, but now we're trying to be middle-aged guys. We're in our early 20s. We're trying to be professional men. And so what I saw was that actually this is probably going to be a favor to me because I was out of a relationship that had no room for me. So I thought it was probably a good thing, and I knew it was going to be shitty for a while. So by then, he was asleep on the couch, so I woke him up and said, tell you what, I'm out of here. You guys take whatever you need to set up your household. Leave my books and my hand tools and my clothing. And you pay for the divorce. I get my name back. And good luck to you guys. And within, maybe 2 weeks, I had pretty well liquidated that life. It was in Southern California.
Wow.
And put everything I had into a trailer and headed north. To my parents' farm in Central California, where I stayed through a really intense winter, a rainy winter, and then left there and went to San Francisco and started over again, started just from scratch, basically. So it was, and that was perfect timing. I mean, I get to San Francisco, it's the mid-60s, the summer of love is coming, drugs are there, you know, I really didn't care what happened to me, so I spent a few years totally stoned, and I kind of watched life unfold in San Francisco. It took me about three years to find my feet. And what I came to was that my initial instinct had been right, survive without bitterness, and I was better off. Ironically, actually, that guy came to visit me in San Francisco to tell me that she had left him.
Wow.
And this is kind of nasty, but I'll just say this because it's just you and me on this line, right?
Yeah, it's just you and me.
Yeah. So I took this guy, my former best friend, down to the Tenderloin District in San Francisco, which in the 60s was still pretty grubby. and got him drunk and left him there. And I've never laid eyes on him since. I mean, I'm sure he's okay. He was a smart guy and a big boy, but we just never had any further contact. That was the end of us.
Wow.
And the end of that chapter of my life. So I picked the pieces up, dated a fine woman who I later married, studied engineering on the GI Bill, and started another life. So that one took 3 years. You know, it seems like each of these sort of life-ending things, I guess the game is to try to shorten it up. I know that one of our teachers says to try to, if you get hit by something, give yourself an hour. Feel as sorry for yourself as you can, bitch and moan and piss, and call anybody who'll put up with you. Then at the end of the hour, shut it down, get back to work. Well, I wasn't that grown up. I didn't get there for actually a couple of decades later.
Well, what I think I'm hearing here is that for a long time, you kept trying to slam doors behind you. Is that?
Yeah, well, I think the instinct is when something goes wrong for a certain personality type, the instinct is to say, well, that didn't hurt me. I mean, I'm disappointed, but that didn't damage me much.
Hmm.
And then, you know, you find out that it isn't until a few months later you find out that you've been leaking blood all over the place or that you weren't so functional. Most of the guys I coach are people who are somewhere between their 30s to their early 60s, and sometimes they're either in denial that they've been hurt or they take that and make that a life pursuit. You know, like, well, here's what happened to me, and this is why. Nah, that's not why. That's just one of the things.
Hmm.
But, you know, you and I have talked, and you know that I think the goal is to get over it and move on, but you can't ignore it. You can't pretend it didn't happen.
Well, I think one of the most...
Seriously.
One of the most important things I've learned is you try to squeeze every drop out of the orange, not only from the standpoint of understanding what happened to you, but also dealing with it emotionally. And I've noticed a lot of things, like it could be something big or something small, but like somebody says something to me and I like go off or get mad and it's like really irrational. It's not just the thing that happened right now that's triggering that. There's usually something a whole lot older than that that's underneath, and like I never finished sorting that thing out emotionally, and so now it just animates all these things that go on in the present. And I think like that's a lot of what happens when people hit midlife stuff is they've got this big strong arm that's been holding the door shut on this. And they're finding, well, they really need their arms for other things. And they're not holding that shut anymore, nor should they. You know, eventually you kind of need to sort things out. And so, you know, it all comes spewing out. And it's like, well, if you keep that clean, or if you go back and clean out the old stuff, then, you know, maybe it's not, a lot of these things are a lot less traumatic.
Well, you know, Perry, you were pretty smart and graceful about the way you worked through it, and it was hard rock mining. Most of the people that I ran into, including myself, we just blew it.
Mm.
I mean, we had our midlife in the 70s, and I actually came through it a little better than a lot of people, just lost it behind cocaine or chasing some completely inappropriate secretary, you know, wrecking things, or you're really wrecking their lives and wrecking huge incomes, wrecking their careers, going to jail. I saw some really stupid stuff go on. And it was because they didn't get that this was something that could be worked through. Of course, I think we live in a more sophisticated age. There's more talk about, you know, when I was in my 30s, you didn't go to a shrink. I mean, that was like going to the chaplain in the military. It just wasn't done. You know, you just had to tough it out on your own. And to know what we know now, I mean, if somebody calls me and they're stuck, it's going to be one of three things. It's always one of three things. Very simple. Either they're real successful in part of their lives, and they don't realize, they don't understand how to transfer that skill set over to the part that's bugging them. That's number one. In other words, the perspective. Number two is they just don't have a strategy to handle that. Other people do, they don't. Okay, that's learnable. And number three, something from their childhood's biting them in the butt. What you talked about, pure and simple. So they tend to become robots. You know, that's what I did for a lot of my adult life. They just tend to be robots. And so their choice set is limited. It narrows down. And since they don't know that what they're going through is weather, basically, they really think it's about them. I mean, when that first marriage blew up, I spent years thinking, well, shit, if my wife and my best friend thought that about me, if they preferred each other to me, what kind of a jerk could I be? You know, I must be real trash.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought when I left high school. Jeez. The idiots, even the jocks, are finishing high school. I couldn't even cope with that. You know, I'm just a piece of shit. So I might as well just go. I mean, it led me into some interesting adventures because I thought I just wasn't worth anything, so might as well do this. Kind of crazy way to think.
Well, hey, you know what? Big, hard one lesson for me. This is a writer downer. In the long run, the problem isn't the wounds and slings and arrows that you get and the damage they cause. I mean, yes, those things are damaging, but the real damage is whatever lie you end up believing that got snuck in with it. That you just put your finger on a really good one.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
If my wife and best friend just betrayed me, I must not be worth very much.
Yeah.
And like, it's like that's what you decided to believe in order to try to minimize the damage.
I thought I was being logical. And the truth is, I needed to choose better people in my life.
Right.
You know, they're perfectly nice people. They were just even more messed up than I was.
So if you add that to your baggage and then you go on believing that, then what, like, you can only wonder, well, what's the next mistake a guy is going to make if that's what he believes?
Yeah, you could do that. You could freeze. I mean, one of the things that happens is sometimes people get timid. My choice was more reckless than that, so I went a different direction. But yeah, you could get timid and stop making choices. And that's a shame too. That's still a life unlived. But, you know, either way you react, whether you fail to live your life to its full potential or whether you throw it away, it's still waste, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's an unjustifiable waste, and it's an illogical one, and it's unrealistic.
You know, I want to circle to something else you said. You said, well, a lot of people are successful in one part of their life, and they're not successful in others.
Yeah.
Now, something I think probably happens to a lot of entrepreneurs is if you're struggling just to make a business work and just to succeed, and that's, like, your biggest desire, then, like, okay, so you focus on that, and you focus that, and you do all these things, and you read, and you listen to people, and, you know, you're hot in pursuit. Now, so, and the way you sort of feel about that is, wow, if I can do, you know, if I could just have a successful business, man, life would be so awesome. Well, you know what? If you go from having an unsuccessful business to having a successful business, believe me, it is a lot better.
Yeah, it's a lot better.
It is absolutely, I mean, there is no doubt about it. And don't believe anybody that tells you otherwise, because it is. It's much better.
That's right.
Much better if you can pay your bills, and much better if you can do some nice things every now and then. Much better if you're getting respect. But, yes, that does create, because there's a little part of your brain that also thinks that that's going to fix everything.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you a couple things that it didn't fix for me. The first thing I noticed was it didn't fix the problems for everybody else. Like, just because Perry has the business that Perry hoped to someday have doesn't change the fact that there's, like, you know, kids dying of AIDS in Africa and, you know, all kinds of crazy things on the evening news every day. It doesn't change any of that. And, you know, funny thing, like, somewhere, some brain cell that I had thought it would. And I don't know where I got that idea, but that wasn't true.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about a gift that you have me set up for the callers at the end of the call.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're going to give away some kind
of
cool.
But it reminds me of something, which is that one of my rules of life is there ain't no such thing as happily ever after. See, and this is what you're talking about. You think as soon as you quit smoking or lose 30 pounds or, you know, get your marriage fixed or get your business successful, everything's going to be fine. Nah, there's still AIDS in Africa and cranky people, you know, for your next-door neighbors, and you still have your kids that you don't understand and a wife who may have grown distant or a husband who
right.
has other interests because you weren't around. So there are lots of domains of life that need to be attended to that don't get fixed just because you pulled it off in one area.
Right, right. And the other thing is that one area sometimes creates a little discontinuity with the rest of your life. You know, like, well, gee, you know, everybody in my business thinks I'm great, so how come everybody at home doesn't think I'm great? Well, they should, shouldn't they? Or, you know, or what did I deserve? I just got yelled at by my spouse. What did I do to deserve that?
I'm working 80 hours a week. I've got a conversion rate of 15%.
right. And I think, like, if you're really struggling, like, if you're in financial problems and stuff like that, a lot of times those other problems seem so small by comparison that you just ignore them. But then if, you know, things can change and then you're like, well, wow, I still have this problem. This problem that I had 15 years ago is still here and it hasn't gone away. So what are you going to do about that? And then you end up like, wow, I think I need to get smart about that too. And what I think it's done for me, you know, I've had to go learn about a lot of new things that I knew nothing about. And it's expanded my universe and what I know about and what I tell you, and it bleeds into what I do in my business. Like a few years ago, I probably would have never had a phone call like this. I wouldn't have known why you would want to have one. Well, you know, people are trying to figure out a lot of things and not just business. So,
well, one of the things that I really admire about you, Perry, is that at 40, you know all this. You've got an operational business, and you have a capacity to do such great good. On my 40th birthday, I was sitting in a river wearing only a cowboy hat, drinking a bottle of wine, wondering what to do next.
Wow. So tell me more about that.
Well, that was a great river. Well, that actually flowed from several steps out of a midlife crisis. I told you mine created more wreckage than yours did. So now we flash forward. I'm 35 years old. I'm now a moderately successful industrial real estate broker in Silicon Valley, working my butt off and making quite good money for the time. And I had a wife and a little girl that I adored, actually the center of my universe. A good marriage with, you know, I married a good friend. Lived in a nice place in the suburbs with an apricot orchard in our backyard. Very nice lifestyle. And it was like mid-afternoon, and I'm sitting in a fern bar in Palo Alto, a very genteel town next to Stanford University, and I'm in one of these bars they had back then with a lot of hanging plants and quiet music, and in the middle of the afternoon, you have some people in there who are staying over from lunch, maybe some college professors or alcoholics or retired people, maybe some ladies who lunch, some housewives, and then you've got some of the early crowd who are leaving work early, and that was me. So I was sitting in this bar, and I wasn't actually out in it. They had a little garden area, but I was actually sitting at the bar. It's like I came to my senses. It's almost like I came out from under an anesthetic, because I don't remember the day before. I mean, I don't remember the day previous to my being in that bar. My memory sort of comes up as I'm sitting there, and I remember looking at my watch, wondering if I could go home yet. Well, that's odd. I said to myself, you're in a place by choice. What's your issue? Well, it's too dark here to read, and people who drink in the afternoon are boring. So I'm thinking, okay, well, why the hell are you here to begin with? Oh, yeah, I'm here because I couldn't stand being in the office anymore. And why did you go home? Well, because it's early in the day. If I went home, I'd have a conversation about why aren't you at the office. And that wouldn't have been all that fun either. And these realizations are just hitting me, slam, 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 and they're deep, deep, deep realizations, like the ones you and I used to talk about were happening in your life. Oh, this all hit me in like a couple of minutes. And the first thing I remember is the bartender coming over and saying, hey, Tom, you okay? And as I looked up at him, I realized my eyes were filled with tears. They were just streaming down my face. And I just said, yeah, Freddie, I'm fine. I got an allergy attack. I'll see you later. So I got up and I got out of there.
I bet bartenders hear things like that all
the time. Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. They hear everything. So I got up and got out of there into the bright sunshine on the street. And I remember walking around and then being afraid I'd be seen by somebody who knew me, getting in my car and driving up the coast, up the bay a ways, and sitting by the bay for a couple of hours just thinking through. It's actually something I read in a book, that people can climb the ladder of success, and as they near the top, they may realize they leaned it against the wrong building.
Sure.
And I realized that I was working hard at work I hated to build a life that I hated. I was betraying myself, and I thought, what kind of an example am I going to set for my kid if I live in a life that I don't belong in? And long story, long ugly story short, that was the beginning of the end of that marriage and my career in real estate. Within 6 months, everything had changed. My entire life had changed. And I was staying in a little apartment that I still drive past every once in a while, trying to figure it out all over again, and working in nonprofit environmental causes. Which I guarantee you does not pay as well as real estate.
Wow, so...
But it came on me. It was just like that truck coming out of a side road. It came on me without warning. And I was so focused on trying to get it, you know, trying to get it right, that I hadn't considered the fit. I hadn't considered me. And I've told people, that's the last bad day I've ever had. Well, I mean, the days my parents died weren't good days. And, you know, I've had some knocks since then. You and I have talked about some of them. But I think that was the last internally created bad day that I've had. That's over 30 years ago. And because before then, most of them were bad. Now, there was laughter, but still there was, most of them were really, really bad.
So what changed?
Sounds like a platitude, and most things do until you start living them. But there's a reason for platitudes, Perry. The reason for these freaking cliches is because they're true. And so the big one was to take responsibility, you know, start owning my life. I mean, literally owning it. My family thought I was crazy. My parents were pissed off. I can't tell you how my wife took the news. You can guess. I would say, in my favor and in her honor, she and I are best friends today. And we've been apart for 30-odd years, and we've team together to raise our daughter, who's a wonderful young woman and a good friend of mine. And the age I was when her mom and I split. So, you know, but that, as I look back on it now, in fact, that ex has often said that if we'd worked as hard at our marriage as we had it at a divorce, we might still be married. And I think she's right. But again, I created the wreckage without thinking. I've been so far down the path that, you know, I created a lot of wreckage. I broke a real estate partnership. I cost some people quite a bit of money. Certainly potential earnings. I mean, there was a lot. There was a lot I had to unravel to step out of that with integrity. It was a mess. And it led into another adventure. I will say this about that experience. I didn't spend a lot of time thinking I was an asshole.
Hmm.
I spent a lot of time thinking I'd been stupid and wondering how to avoid that. But I didn't really, I don't want this to sound cold-blooded, but I got that I needed to be in integrity. I really realized that that's important, that compromise is not, you know, self-sacrifice is noble if it's true self-sacrifice, but that wasn't. That was like settling. That was like selling out. Nothing wrong with the field. I have good friends who have done very well in that field, and I know them today. And I enjoyed what I learned there. On my way to being successful in that field, I learned a tremendous amount about courage and honor and integrity and pressure and cowardice and a lot of things. But it wasn't the field for me.
Now the way I understand your story, you've been through two marriages and lots of wreckage and lots of collateral damage, and somehow you came to decide, okay, things are going to have to get different.
Well, actually, the score is off, Barry. This is my fourth marriage.
Oh.
Now, when my third marriage ended, it was a lot lighter. That just ended on the downstroke. I mean, because good lady and all that. That just ended because I was in a business that I was riding into the ground. And the downside of an entrepreneur's life is rough. So when she told me she was leaving, I wasn't too... She was all melodramatic about it. I was watching the Winter Olympics, and she walked over and turned off the TV in front of me. She said, "We have to talk. We're not going to like this talk." And I thought, oh, shit, what now? She said, "I have to leave." So I guess I'd seen it coming because I'd known that she had married me for reasons of convenience rather than what I'd hoped for. And so I looked at her and I said, "Boy, you know, isn't this been a week? Tuesday, we had to take the cat to the vet. And yesterday, the battery in your car died, and now this." I was just so inoculated against that sort of stuff that, you know, it was a bump. It was a serious bump. Shouldn't have been married. But that one ended literally very smoothly and very convivially. Comparatively speaking.
Well, so, you know, we're not trying to give everybody a downer here, but guess what?
You asked.
You know, guess what? Life gets that way sometimes. You know, and like after the third time, a person can't help but seriously question themselves, right?
Well, I actually wrote in my diary that just because I love women doesn't mean I need to marry them all. So, and I didn't get married again until Vicky in 1998.
Yeah, so somewhere in the middle of that, you said, I got to get better at this.
Well, one of the things, yeah, clearly, I then realized, oh, yeah, my choice-making isn't all that solid here. I'm not one of these commitment-phobic men, and maybe the Marine Corps scrubbed that out of me, but I wasn't afraid to take a position. You just don't need to take them all.
Yeah. Right.
And being a man who loves women and being also a one-woman man, I've always been monogamous. It's a philosophical choice I made when I was younger, and that was another lesson I learned the hard way. But that's a choice I've never regretted except maybe 10,000 times, but never for more than about 30 seconds. So.
Yep.
You know, so that one, yep. that one I really have never had to revisit. That's been a firm decision.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I was in a car after Vicky and I got married, and some very attractive young gal in San Francisco came flouncing across in front of our car while we were at a signal. I'm looking at her, and Jared says, "Hey, Tom, you're married to my mom." And I said, "That's right. I'm married. I'm not blind." So, but that's about the limit.
Right.
So, bad choices can either lead you to the conclusion that you might want to rethink your choice-making mechanism, or they can lead you to the conclusion that you're a failure and a weakling, and a dunce and will never get anything right. You have to decide about that. Now, perhaps that's a decision, that's an evaluation I should have made of myself years ago. I'm glad I didn't. Because I've managed to survive a lot of stupidities and a lot of misfortune and do pretty well and be useful to other people. You know, I've got, it's really good now. I'm surrounded by people who like me. This is way cool.
It's a lot better that way.
Like Neeson on the call. You know, I have people that actually like what I write. You know, they go to my website and they read the stuff and they like it and they find usefulness there. So.
Well, you know what? There is something, whatever kind of work that you do, there's something about being appreciated for that work that really does feed your soul.
It's actually, you know, as a former employer, I really had to study what it was that turned my employees on. And salary was number five on the list. The number one thing on the list is for them to have a sense of meaningfulness about their work. So, yeah, if you don't give yourself that, you've sold out at the...
Yeah.
At a really the basis level.
Yeah. Yeah. So you decided, like, before you decided to get into marriage numero quattro, you did make some kind of decision, like, I'm going to get to the bottom of why I keep screwing up all these relationships.
Well,
or why, what was that?
The basic decision was, well, it wasn't never get married, but it was just don't make that decision for a while, you know, so like for 15 years.
Yeah.
So, and I didn't make that decision. Actually, I was dating a friend of mine that, and that was it. We realized we weren't going to make it permanently, so before we broke the relationship off, we were romantically involved for a while, and we attended a wedding, and I heard a guy at the wedding say that his mom had told him not to marry the woman you can live with, but to marry the one you can't live without.
Hmm.
So I think I just went along until I found that.
Okay.
So, that, I mean, that made a whole difference.
Yeah?
Being an accommodating guy and a man who loves women, they're, I've proven there are lots of women I could live with. And that's not that hard if you're patient. I even wrote an article about it. It's on my website about how to get along with women. But in terms of making a marriage, you know, what you're doing and what I'm doing now, that's a whole different ballgame. And so it's better if you marry the one you can't live without. And, I mean, I obviously could live without Vicky. We're doing quite well independently. But what we have together is so different, so qualitatively different than singlehood or any other married experience I've ever had, that I can tell that this is what they were talking about.
Well, you know, anybody who spends time with Tom and Vicky picks up pretty quick that they're extremely fond of each other. It's a very healthy relationship. And, you know, Vicky had her share of bumps and bruises from before then, too. So,
yeah.
You know, you got two people getting married, you know, multiple marriages, usually the second or third one, the statistics for that one surviving are even worse than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like you're facing pretty serious odds. So you guys decided to think differently than most people. How do you think differently?
Well,
what do you do different than most people?
Well, I think we didn't meet looking for mates.
Hmm.
So I think the big one was we weren't looking, I mean, if I'd, you met her. If I was looking for a mate, it wouldn't have been her. She's too cute, too young, too blonde, too, you know, she's just, you know, and I'm too old, too bald, too intellectual. So it wouldn't, that's not who we would have found. You know, she would have found somebody in her church, and I would have found, well, I don't know where I have found them, just wherever women are. But what happened was we just met as friends, and we just liked talking with each other.
Mm.
I fell in love with her heart, I think, with her sincerity and her earnestness and her spirituality. I mean, she's also not hard to look at, but I fell in love with her personhood, really, as a friend, before I thought, well, you know, if this thing keeps unfolding this way, I think we might be together forever. And I remember when I thought that, and I thought, well, don't freak her out. This woman's a widow. She just, you know, she didn't start college till she was 40, so she's busy building a career as a psychotherapist. give her time, let her catch up. And I did. And she'll tell you that I knew before she did. But I've had more time to give it some thought, and I'm more introspective. So I don't think that's hard. And we still have stuff come up, you know, but because we are on each other's side and give each other the benefit of the doubt, we never make the other person wrong. I mean, her weaknesses endear her to me.
Okay, slow back up, slow down. Could you unpack what you just said?
Well, let me try. Okay. Here's one. Vicki, on occasion, has thought I don't do enough, I don't do my share of work around the house. I know nobody on the call has ever heard this before. So, okay, she thinks that. Well, she has more time to think that, frankly, because I'm in here struggling trying to make a living. And so I say, that's funny you should say that. Here's what I do that I consider my responsibilities. So you never, they're never on the table. So here are the things that just happen automatically. And so I listed the things that happen automatically. The cat box is always clean. The trash is always empty. The dishwasher is usually emptied when I'm here, you know. But then I'm putting in a 60-hour week. So I said, and here are the things I refuse to have any. She said, yeah, but you don't help me with the yard. And I said, we live in a townhouse. The garden's a hobby. And no, I won't help you with the yard. I don't care about the yard. If you want help, hire a gardener. That's not one of the areas where I'm going to spend any time. We have somebody who comes in and cleans this place twice a month. I'm not going to vacuum in between. That's not something I'm ever going to do. So, and that's not something you have to do. So let's negotiate. But because we didn't start out by making each other wrong, we knew we were headed to a place that wasn't about her getting me to change. It wasn't about me getting her to change. It was about the two of us coming up with a lifestyle solution. So it wasn't about somebody making somebody wrong.
Hmm.
I have to say, it broke the hearts of a lot of good women to train me this thoroughly. I remember my daughter's mom, who, as I said, is one of my best friends today, saying to me, we would get home from work about the same time, me from a lab and her from her office, and I'd plop down on the couch, turn on the TV, and she'd go in the kitchen and bustle around and make dinner, and then we'd eat dinner together, and then I'd probably go in my study and read a little bit, and she'd go back in and clean up the kitchen. And one day, I don't know, a year or two later, she said, you know, I'm wondering how this sits with you. You and I both work about the same number of hours, right? We're gone from the apartment about the same time. I said, yeah, so what? She said, well, but then we come back, and I'm the one in the kitchen making dinner and serving it and cleaning up afterwards. That doesn't seem fair to me. And I thought about that. I thought, oh, shit, I don't want to have to cook or wash dishes. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized she was right. It wasn't fair. And then she said, you know, who does the vacuuming, cleans the bathrooms here? It's me. What's fair about that? And, you know, she was right. And I remember what a disappointment it was to me to realize she was right and that we had an unfair relationship. So we had to rebalance it, and we did. And that was like decades before I met Vicki. So, you know, one of the good breaks Vicki has is that I've been trained by a number of women to behave better than I would have ordinarily. And the other thing is, I think I don't really hear any criticism or complaint that Vicki makes as an attack on me.
And that's the adjustment that was made on your side of the fence, not hers.
Yeah, well,
you choose to not hear accusation.
I've done a lot more thinking than she has on the subject. I've had more training. She's a psychotherapist, but I'm an NLP master practitioner. You know, I've had a lot more training, thousands of hours more training in actual interactions, interaction skills. And I'm older, and I screwed up more. I've had more tear-filled arguments. I've had more slammed coffee cups on the table. I've had more slammed doors. You know, in my 20s and 30s, it didn't get violent, but it got noisy. And, you know, talk about sour. I mean, I it's just looking back on it, just saying, damn, what a way to just piss away 35 years of life.
Mm.
You know, being depressed and sour and resentful. And I don't think people who knew me back then would describe me that way, but I know what it felt like inside.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that's where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? All of us on this call, all of us are trying our best to create a life for ourselves and the people we love. But we're all the instruments of our own performance, Stephen Covey says. We're doing it. We're the horses we ride. It's us.
Yeah.
So state management becomes essential, really essential. It's like a top athlete. You know, who really has to manage themselves? Most people don't. They can get up and fall from one foot to the other until it's time to fall into bed, really. I say that with all due respect, but it's true.
Yeah.
Who really has to manage themselves? Athletes, actors, commanding officers, top CEOs, ministers, counselors. You know, the people where the rubber meets the road, they have to manage themselves.
You know, this just made me think of something. I was at this camp last year, and I was sitting at a picnic table, and I happened to be talking to this guy who worked for the Green Bay Packers. And, you know, he was explaining how, okay, so, this is a professional football team, and it's however many $100 million a year and all that stuff, and they spare no expense of anything the players need to do their job, to play that game. And so I'm like, well, like what? And, well, like, you know, if the guy needs a therapist, then they get him a therapist. If the guy needs a massage person, they get him a massage person. If they need a nutrition person, they get him a nutrition person. And you know what's interesting? Like, think how pragmatic and like ruthlessly performance oriented all these professional football teams are. Every single one of them has a chaplain.
Uh-huh.
Now, isn't that interesting?
Well, I don't know. It depends on your worldview. I don't find it, you know, I think a chaplain is as essential, a chaplain and a shrink and a coach. I mean, they're all coaches of one sort or another. They're essential to a whole being.
Well,
these guys, you pull them out of high school and college, and a lot of them are just really muscle and nerves.
Right.
You know, really. So
right.
They're going to need a lot of management because they're being treated like racehorses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's human beings inside there, and they're evolving. And some of them, as we read in the papers, some of them get it wrong.
Right.
You know, you get the drug problems and car crashes and other things. But, yeah, with that kind of money at stake, it makes a lot of sense.
Right.
We are spiritual animals, whether people like to hear that or not. It's the truth.
Well, and so, but also think about what the approach, okay, what you're saying is, well, think of yourself as a one-person professional football team.
That's right.
Not as a one-person professional couch potato.
That's right.
So what do you need?
Or don't think of yourself just as, I think it's, you can do it. I did it, but I don't recommend it. You can think of yourself as your function.
Well, sure.
You're limited, I think. But I think what you're raising is a very important issue. If you want to be a peak performer, then you have to think of yourself as a peak performer.
Right.
That means all challenges accepted, all challenges welcome here,
mm-hmm.
whether intellectual or spiritual or emotional or physical or whatever they are.
Right.
Because that's the way you perform peak. That's the way you get the most out of life.
Right. And you have permission to seek all necessary resources
exactly.
to take yourself to peak performance. And so, like,
right.
one thing about you and that you and I both have in common is we really don't have any limits set on what we'll do to educate and better ourselves.
That's right. Yeah, and if something squeaks, you go looking for an oil can.
Right. And you assume, if I hear a squeak, there must be an oil can somewhere that can fix this squeak.
Well,
there must be somebody somewhere who knows how to solve this problem.
There is. The purpose of this call is actually to assure people that there is.
Yeah.
My story is a story of repeatedly reaching for the oil can. You could comment on how sensible I've been about creating squeaks in my life. You know, and I stand up for that. That's fine. It could be that I've wondered sometimes if my entire purpose in life is to act as a cautionary example to other people.
Right.
But at least I'm good-natured about it.
Yeah.
You want to go to my last little bloodbath?
Yeah. Let's talk about the last bloodbath.
Okay, so I'd come back from a seminar, actually, on a Sunday. Monday I was catching up to things in the office. I was running a company that was doing about $5 million a year in business all over the world, products that I invented and patented that were considered number one, and still are for that matter, in the biopharmaceutical industry. The most critical medicines, biotech medicines made in the world, are using the valves that I designed. And mixers and some other equipment. So I had people all over the world, reps and contacts and companies, and I was on a standards board, and the company was, I think back then it was like 16, 17 years old, and we'd come through the hard times, you know, the early years where every decision you make is placing the company at risk. I still remember those first 3 or 4 years. And then it, you know, grew up enough where your decision is just risk embarrassment before the board. But I did not own the company flat out. Typical Silicon Valley arrangement where I was a minority shareholder and the investors owned most of it. So on Tuesday, we were going to have an informal meeting, myself and the chief investor, just to bring them up to date on plans. But I noticed that a couple of other board members were in the office too. And I asked one of them, why are you here? And he said, the investor thought that I'd like to hear what's going on. Well, as it turned out, when the meeting began, it turned out to be a board meeting that I wasn't aware of as CEO. And at that board meeting, I was fired. And several people who were related to me in the company were taken out also. And I didn't understand why at the time, although I did later. But the significant thing was that in the space of about 5 minutes in that meeting, I realized that the future that I had planned for myself was over, that it was going to end, and end on that day. The complaint I have is that nobody ever mentioned it to me ahead of time, and I understand why now, but I didn't then. And there are reasons for that. Some are personal, having to do with the family of the investor and his own concerns for legacy. He's gone now. He's passed away. But so, you know, the fact that I was intent on taking the company to a different direction, I wanted to grow it rapidly and then sell it. When people's ends and goals diverge, sometimes you don't know about it. So I think what's useful for this call is that my basic experience was realizing, and I could see it from their body language within seconds, these guys have already made this decision. This is not up for discussion. This is a done deal. So my purpose then would be, how can I make sure that my reactions do not aggravate a relationship past whatever point it's already died? Because I'm going to need to negotiate with these guys on whole bunches of things. You know, I had a company and I was concerned with it. Everything that I owned was in those company shares. I had a position in the industry, I had royalties, so I was very concerned with it. I was actually more concerned with the company's welfare on that day than I was with my own. And so what I did was to manage my behavior so that while I didn't endorse the decision, I acceded to it and then did everything I could to make it as easy and smooth as possible. In fact, a year later, after we'd had our legal free-for-all, which was pretty raunchy, afterwards, the investor took me out to lunch and said I'd been a real gentleman through the whole thing because I'd never allowed our dispute to become personal. And I believe it actually made better business for me. It made a better settlement. It saved me some on legal fees. I wouldn't say we're friends anymore. We're not. I'm moving into a completely different area. But it allowed me to conclude that part of my life, even though it ended involuntarily, but to conclude it with the maximum I could take from it. My professional contacts remained solid. The company made a press release that I'd retired, so the insides of our conflict were only known to our real close confidants in the industry. And, you know, then I moved on. The downside, of course, was I have to recreate a retirement because when you own shares in a small company, those shares are worth what the company is worth, and the company is now worth a good deal less than it was when I was running it, and worth about 5% of what it would have been had we followed my plan. So that's my belief. You know, it could be argued differently, of course. I spent a lot of money on lawyers and accountants, so I know that there's two sides to it. But
right.
The bottom line for me, and you and I talked through all this crap, so you actually held the tourniquet on more than one phone call.
Yeah.
But I think the bottom line was get on with it, you know, and don't make it about you. And I would say the larger challenge for me was it was 2 months before my 65th birthday. So, you know, how do you master the holy shit reaction at that point? Now we're 4 years later, and it's fortunately with a lot of your help, I've designed another business which makes use of my experience so that I can share my experience with others, either coaching or with the writings on my website, and pass it on. And that's been, actually, this is the most fulfilling work I've ever done in my life. So it's turned out pretty well. And I look back and I think, you know, I really don't miss that other life at all. I haven't been back in that building since the day I left it.
Well, you know, so a lot of people, the bottom line of this would be, well, you know, you founded this company and you worked there for 15 years and they screwed you over. And
you got to stop right there and say, no, they didn't screw me over. What they did was to surprise me. And they surprised me because of who I am and who they are. What I actually said to them that day was, man, you could have had this job over lunch, you know, if you just talked to me. I mean, you had the votes, so it wasn't about that.
Yeah.
But they didn't know that. And the other guys on the board came from big corporations, and so they had that corporate mentality. And in Silicon Valley, the corporate mentality is change the locks on the door while the guy's cleaning out his office.
Yep.
And that's actually what they did.
Right.
A company that I founded, named, placed, invented the product, did the marketing, and hired every employee there. So I guess I'm pleased that it's still continuing to go because I really like my royalty checks.
Yeah.
But I'm also pleased I have my time free to do other things. So, yeah, I could just live a life that says, oh, I got screwed. But that never seemed very attractive to me.
Because that's, as far as being a story that you're going to tell yourself, that is not, that story does not help you in any way, shape, or form.
In any way, that's right. It's okay to say you got hit by a truck because clearly it was a violent change of lifestyle. At an advanced age, it was a change of expectations. You have nursemaided me through this as I have nursemaided you through your changes. I've had to change my entire work style.
Yeah.
My entire identity has had to shift.
Yeah, going from driving to work and being the president of a company with 20 employees versus being a self-published author, consultant, coach.
That's right.
That's pretty different.
Well, 20 employees and 150 people around the world. You know, I would wake up every morning to emails and phone calls where people had problems that only I could solve. So,
right.
There was a little bit of the king of the world about that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I didn't really have to. The other thing that I've learned that surprised me was how little proactivity was required of me running a company. You need to basically set the goals ahead, but it was very much like driving cattle. You know, you need to keep the herd all moving in the same direction.
It is way easier to just react to things than it is to wake up every morning, set your agenda, I'm going to get these things done, I'm going to move the ball this further down the court, and after I do all that other stuff, that's when I'm going to respond to everybody's pleas for help.
Yeah, that's true.
It's very different.
Excuse me, this is really different. Some parts of that were easier. Of course, I was on a larger stage with more at stake, so the fear factor, when I had a head of a $100 million company that wanted to eat me up, you know, and I knew he had the resources to do it, I had to convince him that I was kamikaze enough that I would make sure that if he got the meal, I would get a sandwich on the way down. And I had to do that more than once, which is what people running small companies need to do if they're not going to get trampled by dinosaurs. So I'd won the grudging respect of some large firms. That was challenging. But nothing like this, where I wake up and the only person I have to face is my biggest devil, me, and my task list and my calendar. And so this has been a real shift, although, as I said, I'm finding it just totally fulfilling. And the people I deal with are, you know, this is my best community, the folks on this call. I want to tell all you on this call how much I love and admire you. You've got such balls. Nobody asks you to do what you're doing. You're creating activity, income, transactions. You're taking the risk. Nobody asks you to do that. You're taking the risk on behalf of every advance that the human race makes. It all started with somebody doing something they weren't asked to do. So I just think that's awesome. And even late in life, I really feel privileged to be part of this this community.
But, you know, it's a pretty thankless job being a startup entrepreneur. I mean, once you get things going, then, yeah, the world sort of does revolve around you a little bit. And, you know, people, well, you know, do they have any job openings over there? And, you know, vendors like you, and they send you Godiva chocolates for Christmas.
Right.
And all that kind of stuff. But, you know, when it's just you, and it's like, well, you know, my expenses last month were $2,500 and my income was $1,500. You know, like, nobody is celebrating you. and you know, not only that, your family or spouse or somebody might resent the drain. And it's like, well, such is the life of the alchemist. You know, and a lot of times what drives the alchemist is like, man, if I have to follow the bumper of the car ahead of me, you know, for the rest of my life, you know, I think if that's what I have to do, I think I'm just gonna like dive off some building somewhere. Like there's gotta be something more interesting and fulfilling than this, and you know, and you're just driven by, you know, I need to do this. And you may be the only one that feels that way for you. Yeah, Tom, go ahead.
I just want to offer something else to, actually, the person that I've been for the last 4 years is not even a successful entrepreneur. You know, this has come very recently. The person I've been for the last 4 years is the wannabe. And you may have folks on this call who wannabe, who want to be, want to have the freedom of self-employment and of pursuing their dream. And I would say to them, I know what that's like, and I would be encouraging and say, there is information available to you. You only need two things. You need sufficient information, and then you need to friggin' do it.
Yeah.
And they take, some of that takes support, some of that takes methodology, but believe me, if you have the information and the methodology and the motivation, you will do it. And if you don't have the motivation, guess what? You can find that. You just Google it online. You can find that. There's always enough information out there for a self-organizing individual to create a life. I love this country. Thank God. You can even get it wrong, and they give you another shot. I mean, it's great.
And there's no such thing as the world running out of needs.
And there's no such thing as too late. You're talking to Mr. Too Late.
Right. Right. So. So I think that there's much to be honored and celebrated about, you know, even the wannabe person. It takes courage to do that. It's not an easy road to hoe. But it's a rewarding one, you know, if you crack through that barrier and get to where you want to go, it is extremely rewarding for the world to run on your terms. It's extremely rewarding to, you know, get out of bed at 7 or 8 or 9 or, you know, whatever your time clock is and go do what you do and be in your talent zone and, you know, be able to contribute your gifts to the world and design your world the way you want it to. And when you are determined to do that, you'll be surprised at how much the rest of the world does move out of the way to let you do that.
Yeah, the world needs us.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, Barack Obama can tell nice stories, but he can't do alchemy.
Well, and just remember that Barack Obama was a guy that nobody asked to do what he did at one point either. So this is really significant.
That's true.
This is significant. This is what I said. I love this country. My dad was an immigrant. Nobody asked him to do that. And he ended up graduating from two universities and singing in the Metropolitan Opera. So anything's possible. Anything at all. And if I had, as I look back, I can't confess to any singular virtue as I look back. I don't see that I had one success characteristic or trait except one, which was persistence. Really, the only thing that I can see looking back over 50 years of being in business was that I just keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't give up on yourselves, I think eventually the world looks away. The odds shift in your favor. You know, eventually, that the locked door loosens up and rattles open. Eventually, you meet the person you need to meet who gives you the idea you need to hear or the pat on the back. So I think I really do believe that that's true.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody's watching us that closely. So if you commit and move persistently, things seem to work out. I'm not wording this very well.
Well, you can say that again. I went to my 10-year high school class reunion, and at that particular time, I was scraping by, okay? And I hated my job, and nothing that I had done had really worked, and I'm thinking, man, I, like, hope nobody figures out, like, how little I've accomplished. You know, nobody was even wondering.
Yeah, they're just glad to see you again.
They're glad to see you, and they're worried, like, well, right. I hope Perry doesn't say anything about the 15 pounds that I gained, or, yeah. You know, they're all, like, thinking the same insecure thoughts. Like, really, it's usually not about you.
Almost never. Everybody walks through the world thinking their fly's unzipped, and everybody knows it. Not true.
So I want to make people aware, like, what it is that Tom does these days, and then Tom's got some gifts that he's going to give away. One of the things that Tom is really good at, and one of the things that he does as a coach, because some of what he does is like one-on-one coaching, is deconstructing, you know, belief systems and things that hold people back. You know, in the entrepreneurial endeavor, there's all the mechanics, but then there's what goes on inside your head and the things that sabotage you. And I think Tom is very good at finding those things, and he and I have had a lot of conversations, and he's fixed my head about a lot of things. So that's one thing that Tom does. And another thing that Tom has been intensely interested in is neurolinguistic programming and how language, like this whole universe of how language is used. And so on his website, he's got a word magic course, and that's a whole little science about, you know, like when somebody like Barack Obama is able to persuade the whole world that, like, he's the next guy, how did he actually do that? Tom is the guy that can tell you that.
Well, you know, Perry, I actually started this at your suggestion, because so many people now are trying to make money on a website. And on a website, see, Obama's got all that, you know, he's got a lot of physical magic that I'm actually now analyzing. And I'll give you guys a little treat about that, too, because I'm now getting into body language. But for most of us, we're stuck behind our keyboards.
Right.
We can't command a television network. We don't get 200,000 people out there in a lawn waving at us. So we've got to do it just with our words. And that's the weakest part of a communication, emotionally. And yet, we all know that marketing, relationship building, and selling is really an emotional process. So, geez, talk about working the wrong end of the lever. And so what I did with Word Magic was to just do an in-depth study of the impact of words themselves on the other person's brain, the person who's on the other side of the screen from you and only has the words. So how can you produce the impact in their brain to make it come alive, to be more emotional than all the other crap they're going to get today? Just think of the emails that come in, and all you have are words, just little black squiggles on a white screen. That's all anybody gets. So how can you make a difference? There's lots of out there that's written, and most of it's valuable, about copywriting. I know I have all the courses. So does Perry. Copywriting is one science. The structure of the phrasing is one science. But you know what? The words you put inside those phrases are what have the actual impact, and people don't know that because they process language psychologically by the phrase. So a client says to me, I can't sleep at night. And I say, oh, so you'd like to sleep at night? He says, yeah, I just told you that. He didn't tell me that. What he told me was what was impossible for him to do. What I told him was what he wanted to do. And as soon as he agreed that it's what he wanted to do, his entire brain chemistry shifted. And it became possible and even desirable.
Now, if you had a hard time grabbing exactly what Tom said, you're starting to get an idea of how subtle and how powerful this really is. So this, you know, there will be future conversations, and those of you who signed up for the call, which is, I guess it's everybody, you'll hear from Tom, and he'll tell you some of these stories, and he'll develop that. So, you know, so watch for emails from Tom, because he always tells a story and always teaches you something with the story. So
that's what old guys do, right? We sit on the porch and we spin stories.
That's right.
I'm just trying to make mine useful to you.
Yeah, yeah. Anything else before we close this up, Tom?
No. I don't think so. You pretty well rung me out. I mean, I've got more war stories, but fortunately, we just veered from R to triple X. So but the lessons were pretty much the same, which is, you know, you put your head on a chopping block, but guess what? The world's dangerous, but it's not deadly. You really have it. Until God says you're out of time, kid, you're not out of time. And you're not out of resources.
You know, you just reminded me of one more point before we give away the bonus.
Yeah.
We have these conversations about burning bushes. Now, not everybody knows the burning bush story. It's in the Bible. It's one of the, you know, stories they tell kids in Sunday school. So Moses kills an Egyptian. And now all of a sudden he's a fugitive. And he's, well, dang, I better hightail it out of here or they're going to throw me in jail.
This so he goes, algebra teacher story, huh?
Yeah, yeah. He's got his, that's right. He winged the book at the algebra teacher, conked him on the head, and he runs and flees. And so he's out there, and now he's a shepherd, and he's, like, tending sheep, which is probably a whole lot less exciting than when he was a, you know, a young buck in Pharaoh's palace or whatever. And he walks by a bush, and it's burning, but it's not burning up. And he's like, what is this? And God says, take off your shoes. This is holy ground. And, you know, Tom made the comment to me a few years ago. He goes, Perry, there's friggin' burning bushes everywhere. Like, everywhere you turn, there's something that's trying to get you to pay attention. And, you know, some of those messages are like from the head office.
Yep. I've written someplace that if you treat your life as scripture, you really get a lot more good out of it. If you treat the events of your life as scripture, what does this mean? What could this be holding for me? Is there a message in here? What's my most constructive and creative response to this? You will be unrecognizable in 30 days. So I invite all of you to consider that.
Yeah.
Just that question is a virtual question. If that becomes the question you ask yourself during your day, it changes everything about your brain. It changes you so much that the cumulative effect will be huge.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Tom, tell everybody where they can go to get the bonus and what it is that you're giving away. I mean, we didn't even tell anybody.
Yeah.
But I said, let's give people something for staying on the call. What is it?
Well, the first thing is an article that I wrote that some of you may have read, but it's the thing that's got the most attention of anything I've done, and I call it 12 Truths. And I've turned it into a PDF and actually fleshed it out a little bit after it was on Lifehacker. I got a lot of comments about it and some things that were a little fuzzy and people didn't understand. Basically, this is my facts of life. And I used to be too modest to say, you know, that this just works for me, but no. Actually, these 12 truths work for anybody. So that's just the way it is. I'm old enough now. I've survived enough. I think I can say that. So,
Tom's irreducible truths of life.
It's true. I mean, this is it. These 12, there are more, but these 12 are pretty functional. You can find those. Then something else, and I'll tell you this, and then I'll tell you why we named the page. The page is tomhubiar.com/Saturday. I'll tell you why we named it Saturday. That's without capitalizing. We named it Saturday because after I put the 12 truths up, I thought, well, you know, lots of Perry's guys have this, and women. I know because I've gotten feedback, and I want to put something else up there. So I've been working on this body language thing, and it's very, very important. 93% of the emotional impact of a communication is nonverbal. And so what I did was just to trap a couple of three, four real quick things that would be hugely useful to people to practice. And I wrote it up, suggested how to practice it, and I think it's that's up there, too. It's called Body Language Intro or something. Now, the reason I titled the web page Saturday is because I couldn't get the damn body language PDF to go on the page so you could download it. And Perry figured it out like 1 minute before this call went on. So it's not pretty, but it's there. Thank you, WordPress. So if you go to tomhubiar.com/Saturday, you'll find two documents, PDFs. If you click on them, they'll download to your desktop. And I just hope that you enjoy them and find them useful.
I think people will. I think the 12 truths thing is great. You can really sink your teeth into it. And hey, you know, it's not every day that somebody that's had 68 years of like really interesting adventures actually crunches it down to whatever it is, 5 pages or something.
Yep, well, it's larger than that now.
And you might want to read that a few times. So anyway, Tom, this has been great. People can go to tomhubiar.com/Saturday.
That's right.
It's not my website. It's Tom's.
Thank you, Perry. If you tell your friends about this, you can send them to Tom Hubiar. If you don't want to spell it, send them to streetsmartceo.com. We'll take them to the same place. And there's a lot of freebies there.
Yeah, there's some good stuff. So thank you, everyone. Really glad that you were here. And hope that you have a fantastic weekend and a happy Friday. So
have a great weekend, folks, and thank you for your patience and your time.
Thank you, Tom. See ya.
Okay.
Bye.